One of my favorite restaurants is a place called the Balkan Grill. It's right underneath the O'Hare Hilton, right down in the. They serve food from the Balkan countries. I usually eat there when I come in. And the place was empty. It was about 5 minutes to ten, and I hadn't eaten yet. And I went downstairs. The restaurant was completely empty, 5 to 10 on a Saturday. I've never seen that before. It's usually a very busy, busy place. And I had the most remarkable experience. Someone was sent to me. His name was Zia. Z-I-A is his name. And he's from a place in the world where there is no country. Did you know there were places in the world that there are no countries? I didn't either. And he said they won't let them be countries. When too many people start to congregate where he lives and where his father lived and his grandfather, they make them spread out. So that there's no governments and nobody to come in and impose how we have to behave and impose laws on us and rules and so on. That each unit that lives there is sort of their own family unit. And it's a place in the world between Afghanistan and Pakistan in the mountains. And this man looked like he might have been from Afghanistan or someplace like that. A very heavy, thick accent. And he, for some reason, he just walked over to my table. He was my waiter. And he just began to talk, and he forgot about ordering my food, forgot to know if I wanted a beer or not, and he just started talking to me. And I was sitting there thinking, if I could be recording what he is saying, he could have given the talk today. It was just, it was astounding, the things that he was telling me. He told me about his great uncle, who died at 72, and one of the words that he said to me was that he was a very young man. And he died at 72, and I thought, that's an interesting comment, because a man living to 72 in our country, while 72 isn't thought of as old, it still isn't thought of as young either in our culture. And he said, oh yes, he was very young. He said, my grandfather is still living. He's 111. And his grandmother is living, and she's 107. And his father is a very vibrant, healthy man of about 84 or 85. And when he was talking about his granduncle, well, his uncle was somebody who had left Afghanistan back in the 20s, I guess, and had become a very famous doctor. He'd come over to this country, and he had traveled all over the world, and he had spoken that he had a practice in London and a practice in here in Chicago and a practice in New York, and he was a consultant, and he was going on and on with great, wonderful pride about this uncle of his. And he said, when his uncle was dying, and here he is telling me that. I mean, imagine a waiter telling, this has never happened. I eat out 5-6 nights a week. I've never heard a sermon from a waiter before that was so profound. And it was all like very, very simple truth. He was so full of himself. It was like, what you have to learn how to do sometimes is to really learn what the Japanese call muga, M-U-G-A. I write about it in The Sky's the Limit, or it's also called Shibumi, which is also the title of a novel, which is a wonderful novel, by the way, I recommend to you. It is this sort of ability that Maslow talked about, of being able to get into a present moment and have a peak experience, and to live it and totally devour only what is in this moment. In the Japanese culture, they use the metaphor of learning how to drink tea from an empty cup. Okay, and to experience the tea and to taste it and to have the vision of it and the feel of it and the experience of it and so on. And that's what that moment was like for me last night for about 40 minutes. It was, do you ever get those moments when things start going up and down your spine? They call it kvelling in Hebrew. it's sort of an internal kind of joy. And I didn't want it to go away, and I didn't want him to go away. And I didn't want the dinner to stop, and I didn't want anybody else to walk into the restaurant so that he would have to wait on them. After he took my order, he would go, and he would come back, and he would pick up the story exactly in the very spot where he had left it. He never missed a beat. And he talked about when his uncle was dying, and that his own children were in the room, and he knew he was going to die in 30 minutes. He knew that it was his turn, it was his time. And he said that he didn't call in his own children to talk to them, because He didn't think they could be truthful, or that he could be truthful with them, because there was too much of a closeness there. And he had some things that he wanted to say before he checked out. So he called in this Zia, who was his nephew, and he said, I called you in. I just want to share with you and be with you before I leave. He said, you know, I'm a very prominent person, and I've really worked very hard all my life and everything, but he said that I don't know why I did it all. He said that here I am 72, a young man, and I'm getting ready to die, and I know I'm dying. And he said, I worked so hard, and I spent all my time trying to become prominent, and I have lots of acquisitions, and I have a... And he said, I'm a mountain clansman from the mountains of southern Afghanistan, which is not in Afghanistan. Because I asked him, if something happened to somebody who lived there, what country... I kept trying to trick him and say, what country would they put on your passport? He said, there are no passports. there's nothing like that. He said, it is not a country. There is none of the, there is no government. We won't allow that. He kept insisting that that was... And so I want to check that out and find out. But he said, I don't know why I did all of those things I did. He said, my whole life I spent, the 72-year-old man, my whole life I spent being consumed with acquisitions and trying to get things and trying to get someplace and trying to make a big difference. And I really didn't put the focus where it really should be at all. It was a very strange, wonderful experience. The truth that he was talking about just really touched me very deeply. I wonder, as I think about what it is that all of us want in our lives and how we're going to get there, so often we make wants and goals and where we're going the most important part of our life. We operate from this premise, and this is probably the most important thing that I've learned when I took up the baton from Maslow. He had said that most people are what we call deficiency motivated, okay? That is, we try to raise our children and we look at ourselves and we say, where would I like to go? What are my goals? How much money can I make? So what we do in order to motivate ourselves is we say that where I am in this moment is somehow deficient, somehow wrong. I have to look at myself and say I'm operating from lack in my life. All right? Now, this is a major, major conflict for people who want to have a, what I call a no-limit life or live a self-actualized life. You must never start in your life from where you are as being deficient, and I will get to where I want to go by repairing my deficiencies, by improving upon the things that I don't have, okay? See, I don't think it's important to have a goal. I think the big difference between where I am now and where I was 10 years ago is that I believe you have to be. I believe in being, not striving. Arriving. Right? You have to be your goal, as it were. You have to not be looking for the truth, you have to be truth. You can't be looking for healing or a healing method out there at all. You have to be truth. And when you are it, it is never something that eludes you. I just had a great experience. On the 1st of January of this year, I quit drinking caffeine. Okay? I had a bad addiction to not Coca-Cola, but Diet Coke, Tab. I could drink a crowd pleaser. Easy. In a speech, I could. Or Diet Pepsi or one of those things. Those big 64-ouncers. I mean, I was drinking 8 to 10 cans of that stuff a day. Inadvertently, I mean, I just didn't know. I'd have it for breakfast, I'd have it in the afternoon, and I'd always had one when I was driving, and whenever I'd give a speech, I had one. And my wife had said to me, and everybody who knew me was saying to me, that's the thing that's got you. That's the one that you can't get rid of. You know, you talk about being... And you know it's not good for you. You know how you feel when you drink too much of that stuff. Then I heard a tape by a man named Ram Dass. Ram Dass had a tape about this Buddhist monk who was the son of a Buddhist saint. And this Buddhist saint was a woman. And there's only been like 4 female Buddhist saints ever in the Theravadan Buddhism. And the woman was very upset with her son because he was a narc in Thailand. All right? And in Thailand, they have the highest incidence of heroin addiction in the world. The heroin addicts are on the streets everywhere. The woman would say to her son, instead of imprisoning these people, instead of punishing them, instead of putting them in jail, instead of all of these things that you do, why don't you try to help them? Why don't you send them love? Why don't you, as a saint would say, okay? And he said, but I don't know what to do. And she encouraged him to study Theravadan Buddhism. And he did. And this is the most austere of all of the fields of Buddhism. It is the area of Buddhism in which you have to practice like 130 austerities a day. All right? You don't sleep on a mattress, you sleep on the floor, you don't look at anybody of the opposite sex, you don't dance, you watch every single thing that you eat, you say prayers all the time. I mean, a lot of these austerities, physical austerities. Well, he got into it, okay? And he thought that these people were too wild for him, right? So he invented like 30 more austerities of his own. And he was practicing 160 of them a day. And Ram Dass said when he met him, he was like meeting a tree trunk, all right? He was that firm. And what he would do is he would take this truck and he would go through the streets of Bangkok. And he would say to the heroin addicts, if you want to get rid of your addiction in 1 week, 1 week's time, jump on the truck and we'll take you to the monastery and you'll be rid of it in 1 week, guaranteed. He would get these large numbers of people that would jump on. Every week he would take another batch of these addicts. I mean, and I'm talking heroin, the hardest thing in the world for us to overcome with will. And he would take them there, and the first thing he would say to them was, this is your only chance. This is the only chance that you're going to have in life to be rid of your addiction. And then he would say to them, I am the treatment. I am bigger than the addiction. And I will show you that. And he would take heroin. And he wouldn't have any effect on him at all. He just wouldn't even react to it. His mind. He had trained himself to be bigger than the addiction and showed them that. And then he would put them through this violent purging, vomiting kind of thing to cleanse out their system and so on. But the thing that he talked about that is the most profound to me is the idea of becoming the treatment, being, the psychology of being. I have taken Maslow's notion of the psychology of being to levels now in my life to challenge myself in areas that I never thought were even possible before. And one of them was with this minor addiction, caffeine, Tab. I mean, he would laugh. Tab? You're having trouble with Tab? I admit it's not major, okay? But nevertheless, for me, it owned me. And I let it own me for over 20 years, all right? This was the stuff that was, it was my last addiction, if you will. Smoking had been something I hadn't had anything to do with for 25 years. And drinking, no part of it. It doesn't interest me. And putting poisons into my body and all of these kind of things. And keeping myself in shape, no problem. It was this thing that I kept holding on to. So what I did on the 1st of January this year is I re-listened to that tape and I became the treatment. It's an amazing thing. See, when you take something into your body that you know isn't good for you or that you don't like, or let's say it's a cigarette if that's what you're trying to quit, or if it's alcohol or caffeine or too much sugar or whatever it is, and you consume that, what happens is as that goes through you, it becomes you. You become it. You become one with the poison. And every time you do that, you are the poison. You're not consuming poison. You are not using a method of putting poison into your system. It's not that. That's one step removed from being. Being means you are it. It is you. You are one. You are at unity with the poison. All you have to understand with any addiction that you may have, any kind of an addiction, is that once you become the treatment and you stop being the poison, it's not even a challenge anymore. I mean, it's so easy that it's disgusting to me. I mean, I feel so superior when I walk by a Coca-Cola machine and I see that button that I always used to push. I mean, I just go, but I'm not that anymore. That's not what I am anymore. Not that I've mastered it or that I've got a method that's great that I want to tell you about this method. It's that I am no longer it. It is no longer me. And I am someplace else now. When you get that, when you understand that notion of being and beginning to apply that in your life, I mean, it's just phenomenal. It's like in religion, people are looking for the Ten Commandments, okay? But in the Bible, it says live of the truth, doesn't it? The whole idea of the kingdom of heaven, I mean, that's one of the great secrets of the universe that is so simple. I mean, the kingdom of heaven isn't this place that you're going to get to. It is within. It is what you carry around with you. And when you are the Ten Commandments, you don't need them. You don't need any of that. You simply are being that. And when that is you and you are it, you are what they call, what Christ called, of the truth. All right? Not looking for it, not trying to get it from someone else, not hoping that someone else can reveal it to you. It is what you are.
When you are looking for love, it will always elude you. When you're looking for happiness, it will always elude you. When you become those things, it's just there, and it begins to own you. You don't have it. It has you. It has a hold of you. So the first benefit that I can think of in approaching life from this loving, giving love away and having it for yourself, filling yourself up with it, is that you will see dramatic changes in the negative kinds of lifestyle things that you have accepted as a way of life for you. Smoking becomes something that's almost too easy to give up. It's almost too easy. You don't tell yourself it's difficult. You don't tell yourself that I'm going to go through a lot of pain and that it's going to be a troublesome thing for me and I'm going to go through withdrawal. You simply become a person who no longer wants to poison himself or herself. And looking at cigarettes as something that you're pouring inside of you, the self that you feel so good about, is just impossible after a while. It owns you. This health approach, this wellness approach begins to own you.
Is it partly because you see yourself as being more valuable now?
I don't think it's because you're more valuable. I think it's because it conflicts with who you are now. See, I'm not saying that where you are now is bad. I don't want anybody to look at themselves and saying, these are all my bad habits and I want to eliminate them. That's the least effective way to change anything about yourself, right? Because you have to quit and you have to stop and you have to lose if it's weight or whatever. Those are all very negative words, right? When you visualize yourself the way you want to be, and you treat yourself according to that image that you have for yourself, then the rest of it is just natural. It is just the way to go. What you have to do is understand that high-functioning people look at where they are and say, that's fine. It's terrific. Where I am is just perfect. I am one of God's perfect creatures on this planet, a perfect creation. But I can grow. And that's not inconsistent at all. It's very much like looking at the sky and say, what's the sky today? Is it perfect? You say, well, it's the only sky we have. It's blue. It's got a few clouds in it. It's sure it's perfect. You look at it an hour later, it's quite different. Still perfect. Things can change, and the perfection doesn't have to change. All right? That may be what perfection is, in fact, as human beings, to recognize ourselves as always changing. I began to look at this concept called mastery, where you become to your own life like a great painter becomes to his creation or her creation, shading it, shaping it, coloring it, putting it in exact tones that you want it to be. So you are creating your own life. I believe that all human beings are geniuses and have mastery or self-actualization, whatever you want to call it, available to them if they want to make the choices that go with it.